these seven scout leaders were removed from scouting because they sexually abused Boy Scouts.
Cases in Alaska from the Boy Scouts perversion files. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 19th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a look at issue advertising in Alaska this campaign season.
If they are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, the public should know how much is being spent and who the contributors are.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. According to the Alaska Energy Authority and its partners, an average of $5.7 billion is spent annually on energy in Alaska. October is Energy Awareness Month, and for tips on how to save, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
The Boy Scouts of America yesterday publicly released more than 14,000 pages of the previously confidential so-called perversion files. The records name 1,200 alleged perpetrators across the country, including several in Alaska. KSKA's Dacia Eaton reports.
The files released show that seven scout leaders in Alaska used their position of power and trust to abuse children in five communities. The men named in the files volunteered with troops in Juneau, Fairbanks, Kotzebue, Ketchikan, Homer, and at Eielson Air Force Base between 1965 and 1985. Steve Crew is an attorney with the Portland law firm O'Donnell, Clark & Crew that brought the case against the Boy Scouts all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court, forcing the release of files containing the names of the alleged perpetrators.
These files were in their, what they call their ineligible volunteers. So these seven scout leaders were removed from scouting because they sexually abused Boy Scouts. And so they were kicked out, but they were never turned over to law enforcement. And I don't believe the parents were ever told about this. So it was basically hidden.
Crew says the Boy Scouts hid the information in their so-called perversion files, a set of files detailing individual incidents of alleged sexual abuse within scouting that the organization kept since the 1920s. The documents released were the centerpiece of a 2010 trial in which attorneys proved that the Boy Scouts of America knew for decades that they had an institution-wide problem with sex abuse, but kept it from the public. The case ended with a jury verdict of nearly $20 million against the Boy Scouts on behalf of a man abused as a boy by a scoutmaster. The files, Crew says, reveal that in the majority of cases, the Boy Scouts did not share information it gathered about abuse with law enforcement, and that abusers were often able to relocate, work in scouts again, and continue abusing children. Clifford Crismore is the current CEO at Boy Scouts of America Great Alaska Council in Anchorage. He says the scouts started scrutinizing volunteer applications more closely in the 1980s.
We don't process it until they've completed youth protection training, which is our policies on how the interaction between youth and adults occur. For example, one-on-one activity is prohibited. There always has to be two adults on the activity. Once they've taken the youth protection training, then we do a criminal background check. And if for whatever reason there's something that comes up on the criminal background check, we can deny membership at that time.
Crew says his firm is working to make the remaining files from 1985 to 2012 public, but Crismore with the Scouts says he expects there to be far fewer cases because of the Scouts' more stringent policies. Attorneys with O'Donnell, Clark, and Crew say there is still one case pending concerning a volunteer who led a scouting troop in Anchorage in the 1970s. The perpetrator in that case is not listed in the files released. Attorneys say that scout officials destroyed approximately half of all files in the mid-1970s. If the remaining case goes forward, the trial will be held in Anchorage. Alaska does not have a statute of limitations on felony sexual abuse cases. In Anchorage, I'm Dacia Eaton.
All but one seat in the state legislature is up for re-election this fall. Combine that with the controversial issue of oil tax reform, and Alaskans are hearing and seeing a lot of political ads this campaign season. The Alaska Public Interest Research Group released a report yesterday that compiles spending amounts from groups releasing so-called issue ads in the state. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
If you listen to commercial radio in Alaska, you're probably hearing ads that sound something like this.
Oil pays the bills, so the burden doesn't fall on us. That's why I'm voting for more oil, more jobs, a stronger economy. I'm voting for oil tax reform.
The ad is funded by the Make Alaska Competitive Coalition, a group that wants the state to lower oil taxes. Because they don't name specific candidates, MAC does not have to register with the Alaska Public Offices Commission. But Jim Sykes with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, or ACPIRC, says that is a line the ads come very close to crossing.
It was, I'm voting for, but there's nothing on the ballot. There is nothing that you can actually vote for in terms of you can't vote for against lowering oil taxes. So the only thing that you can vote for in this election is a candidate.
According to ACPIRC, the Make Alaska Competitive ads are part of the first major wave of unregulated political ads in the state in the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision that allows unrestricted political spending by companies and unions. After that decision, the Alaska legislature passed a law creating reporting requirements for issue groups, but only if they are advocating for or against specific candidates. Matt Wallace is ACPIRG's executive director. He says the public deserves better information on groups that produce more general issue ads, too.
They should register and they should disclose. If they are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, whether they do it officially or not, the public should know how much is being spent. And who the contributors are.
The Make Alaska Competitive Coalition does provide a list of its corporate and individual donors on its website. The group says it does not accept money from oil companies. Jason Moore is a spokesperson for the group. He won't say specifically how much MAC is spending on issue ads in Alaska, only that their fundraising goal is between $300,000 and $500,000. He says the group is operating well within the law.
We have Republicans and Democrats both that make up the coalition. And so we are not interested in trying to affect any political race. We're just interested in the sole issue of doing something about our oil taxes so we can increase investment and generate more oil production, which the state desperately needs.
The ACPIRG report lists two other issue groups that are disclosing their spending amounts and supporters to the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The Putting Alaskans First Committee is releasing ads supporting the bipartisan coalition in the state Senate that rejected Governor Parnell's bill to lower oil taxes. The committee has spent almost $300,000 to date on advertising. In contrast, the We Are Alaska group is releasing ads against the Senate bipartisan coalition. They have spent about $85,000. Ads from both groups name specific senators to vote for or against. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The unemployment rate in Alaska fell last month. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it continues to be lower than the national average.
The seasonally adjusted unemployment rate in Alaska was 7.5% in September. That's 0.2% lower than August. The State Department of Labor revised its August figure downward 0.1% to 7.7%. Nationally, the unemployment rate is 7.8%, which is the lowest it's been since January 2009. Alaska's rate has been lower than the national average since the end of 2008. The September numbers in Alaska are welcome news. The state unemployment rate had been ticking upward for 4 months. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
John Marvin Jr. is competent to stand trial. That ruling came out today from Superior Court Judge David George in Juneau after hearing from two psychologists. Marvin is being charged with murder and weapons misconduct in connection with the deaths of Hoonah police officers Matt Tukuoka and Tony Wallace in August of 2010. Jury selection is expected to start Monday. The trial could last 2 weeks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Puppy Diaries.
It's just past 11 o'clock p.m. Otis is asleep in his crate.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention continues in Anchorage through Saturday when delegates vote on a slate of resolutions. The resolutions determine AFN's course of action during the next 12 months and beyond, and if this morning's sessions were any indication, Alaska Natives are gathering their collective political clout to gain greater control over every level of their lives. Liz Medicine Crow, an AFN presenter who is president of First Alaskans Institute, represents a new generation of Alaska Native leaders.
Well, I think that that's absolutely one of the most important things that as a young Native person is really empowering to me. I hear our leadership that have been here and have been in this whole process and this whole movement since we started contact even, you know, this whole idea, this whole passage of this concept that Native people are the people of this land, and as such that we need to step into those roles of ownership and responsibility. And I think what you're hearing is our people are coming back full force to understanding that that is who we are and that is what we are going to do.
Five work sessions held on Thursday covered the compelling issues of health, energy, education, tribal-state relations, and subsistence. The results of those sessions were presented this morning. Former state legislator Reggie Jewell, now mayor of the Northwest Arctic Borough, said the conversation about tribal-state relations was productive.
It's not like we do not have a relationship with the state government at different levels. Where are our successes? Acknowledge them, celebrate them, because it isn't all filled with animosity. But yet, having said that, there is work yet to be done. We heard, I think, a wide range of good dialogue yesterday. There's issues that came up of the administration should have either a division, an office of some sort of Native Affairs.
Attendees used remote technology to approve a recommendation to have the Tribal State Working Group research and make a plan to create Department of Native Affairs as a cabinet-level position in the state government. The consensor technology allowed the general audience to vote yes or no on recommendations presented by the working groups. Of course, the issue of subsistence underlies all aspects of Alaska Native life. Rosita Wuerl, who heads the Alaska Heritage Institute, read parts of a proclamation written at the subsistence work session.
And the two major goals are lasting federal protections for Alaska Native hunting, fishing, and gathering. We said Native hunting, fishing, and gathering, not rural. Our second major goal is co-equal management of fish and wildlife and other renewable resources for subsistence. And we know we have enough models that we've already demonstrated that Alaska Natives have the capability to do that.
Wuerl said Alaska Natives will work to revoke federal laws that undermine subsistence rights. The target for this action is the clause in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which extinguishes Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights in Alaska. Representatives from Circumpolar Nations are in Fairbanks to preview venues and plan for the 2014 Arctic Winter Games. The last time the youth sporting event was held in Alaska was in Kenai in 2006. The Games International Committee includes members from Alaska, Canadian provinces, Greenland, the Scandinavian Arctic, and Russia. And as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, they like what they're seeing in Fairbanks.
Arctic Winter Games committee members toured Fairbanks venues, including local schools, ski areas, the Carlson Center, Fort Wainwright, and the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Committee President Jerry Thick of Whitehorse says Fairbanks offers a premium location for the biannual showcase of youth winter and traditional Native sports.
All the facilities are exceptional, phenomenal. The only challenge here will be making the people aware of Arctic Winter Games. You're a very large community, and that's kind of the key for the organizing committee to make sure that there's an awareness of Arctic Winter Games, what Arctic Winter Games is about.
Thick says the other communities represented in the Arctic Winter Games are smaller than Fairbanks and Anchorage. Jeff Satinek is chef de mission or head of Team Nunavut Canada. He says coming to Fairbanks is a big deal for team members.
Kids come from all over the territory, so some come from Iqaluit, which is our capital, which is our biggest community. And then you'll have some kids that are come from small communities, like where there's only 400 or 500 people in it. So being in a bigger place, the scenery, the mountains, and the shopping, like, it's going to be good to see them when they see the facilities here. Like, some of them will be awestruck, or they'll feel they're important.
Satinek stresses the Arctic Winter Games is about more than sport, allowing kids from different cultures to come together and make friends. Team Alaska assistant chef de mission Kathleen Ream of Anchorage says there are some major advantages to having the games in Fairbanks.
There's always the element and the benefit of the fact that we are the home team. So for our athletes, the experience will be different because their parents and their family and their support network will be able to attend the games. The community, Fairbanks community, is just one in a million, incredibly supportive of the games, very welcoming to all of us. So it's just a guaranteed good experience for athletes, coaches, mission staff, all around.
Ream says Fairbanks is ideal size for the games, offering a lot in terms of venues and activities, but still small enough that events will get public attention. Fairbanks Arctic Winter Games Board of Directors President Jeff Jacobson says the games have been carefully planned to ensure they're in the spotlight.
Spring vacation in March, a lot of things happen in our community with the World Ice Carving Championships, the Dog Mushing Championships that are going on, Doyon Shareholders, Tanah Chiefs. So we were very careful in talking to those organizations and structuring our games and venues so that they are complementary and they're not competing for the same resources. And we really believe that there will be a great synergism that's going to be happening. So Fairbanks will be the place to be in Alaska during that time period in March 2014.
Jacobson says 50-plus local committees will work to organize various aspects of the games, from hospitality to transportation and security. He says more than 2,000 volunteers will be needed to support the event. The budget is $6.2 million, but Jacobson anticipates the games will bring twice that into Fairbanks, as 2,000 athletes, coaches, media, friends, and family converge on the community. The state has contributed $1.5 million to the budget, and another $1 million will be sought from the legislature next session. Jacobson says local fundraising is nearing $500,000, and sponsors, ticket, and merchandise sales are anticipated to cover remaining costs. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bioneers in Alaska, presenting practical sustainability strategies for Alaskans at its 9th annual conference, October 26th through the 28th at UAA. Bioneersinalaska.org. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Rosemary Alexander, the proud owner of 4 border collies and 3 pups about to go to new homes. This week on AK, puppy love. Dogs are an important part of life in Alaska. They're revered as great athletes and celebrated as trusty companions. And when Bethel reporter Mark Earhart moved to the state recently, he had no trouble jumping on the dog-loving bandwagon. He eagerly anticipated owning his first dog and a few months ago brought home an adorable sled dog puppy. We'll let him take the story from there.
So I got a sled dog, an Alaskan husky, and I named him Otis.
Where are you going?
What are you doing in the back seat?
Otis, come on. Come on.
Outside, come on. Yep.
Good dog. As we get out of the car, his ears perk up. He runs straight for the sound of the howls. This is where Otis was born, in a doghouse surrounded by 15 or so other canines that know nothing else but to eat, sleep, and run. That's Big Girl, Otis's sister. Contrary to her name, she's not so big, but man, is she fierce. She's the only one of Otis's siblings that didn't get adopted, and she eats a grown dog share here at the yard. And that's my boy Otis. He's bigger than his sister, lean and lanky, with the sweetest big brown eyes you can imagine. He doesn't have Big Girl's attitude, but he will take it to her when he needs to. I'm at the dog yard filling in for my friend, a musher who's away for work. I just have to give the dog some food and water. The food I get from the shed and the water I get from a big metal rain receptacle. It was cold the night before, so there's a thick sheen of ice on the water. But the axe fixes that. I leave Otis and Big Girl howling, nipping and fighting in the pen, and go to feed the other dogs. Go back in time 1 month and our story is a little different. I was a new dog owner, and to say the least, I was a little melodramatic about waking up to whines and howls in the middle of the night.
Captain's log. It's just past 11 o'clock. P.M. Otis is asleep in his crate. I put the Mexican blanket I bought in Omaha, Nebraska for $5 over it so the light wouldn't creep in. Over and out.
I'd never really had a dog on my own before, and I was terrified I'd break him. Or I'd teach him wrong and he'd become a rebel who went number two under my covers. Or a miraculously smart dog who figured out how to use the toaster oven to heat up his treats and accidentally burn the house down. But that didn't happen, and slowly but surely we started to get used to each other, even began to like each other.
What are you sniffing, huh? What are you sniffing?
We started to do everything together, watching movies, playing with the ball, going out to look at stuff in the street and eating cold hot dogs. Otis would even watch me wash the dishes.
I think a piece of me really needed him so that I could love something, you know? Because I'm only 24 and I'm single and, you know, away from all my family and friends. And I've made new friends and a new family, but I think I just needed somebody to love, and he happens to be 8 pounds, salt and pepper hair, and really big front paws.
And hell, he even started listening to me.
Otis, sit. Sit.
Good boy.
In my job as a news reporter, I go wherever the news is. My first weekend away from Otis was spent in Akiak, Alaska, covering an erosion disaster. I interviewed Mike Williams Sr., one of the most respected mushers in the state, at his dog yard. He's going to run his 15th Iditarod this year.
I just recently got a puppy myself. He's only 2 months old. Do you have any advice for me?
Take good care of him and feed him good and keep him exercised. You know, these dogs have been running for over.
Now flash forward to the present as I walk through the tundra grass with Otis and his sister, Big Girl. It's been only a little over a month, but I'm not scared of hurting him or training him poorly anymore.
Come on, guys, let's go for a walk.
I see him dart over frozen pools of water, tackling his sister, and I laugh. For AK, I'm Mark Earhart.
Now it's time for 300 Villages, and where else would we go for a show about dogs than Nome, the town on the edge of the Bering Sea that hosts the finish of the annual Iditarod sled dog race.
My name is Dennis Richardson. I am currently the manager at the Nome Convention and Visitors Bureau. The community of Nome is a community of about 3,500 people. We have the full-time airport, the 3 flights a day plus cargo flights coming in, as well as the deep water port of Nome. So we're pretty much like a transportation hub for all of the outlying communities. Nome was originally founded in 1899. When the gold rush was discovered here at the Nome River, and it grew up within a year to a population of about 40,000 people. Nome has its beauty. I mean, out on the north end are all of the mountains, the Cougar Rock Mountains, and further south east, excuse me, is Safety Sound, which is a large freshwater, saltwater estuary with larger mountain ranges. So once you get off the coast itself, it opens up for a whole lot of possibilities of hiking and wildlife watching. The Iditarod has pretty much developed into a large winter carnival that happens in March. It's the end of a 1,000-mile dog sled race that starts in Anchorage. It takes about anywhere between 10 days and 2 weeks. It became a race in the late 60s, I believe it was, and it's basically just a huge dog sledding event. It's a huge community event. It's 2 weeks' worth of activities, parties, celebrations, dinners, potlucks. Oh, the summer of 2012, there was a huge new gold rush. I believe that there were, in previous years, approximately 40 or 50 off-water dredges. And then with the Discovery Channel and their two shows, Bering Sea Gold and Bering Sea Gold Under the Ice, it sparked a huge new interest and resurgence in gold fever. And I believe this year we had approximately 150 dredges in the water. Right now, things are pretty much winding down. It's late fall. The port is beginning to freeze up. Tourist season is over. Everybody's just getting ready to hunker down for the winter.
That was Dennis Richardson, manager of the Nome Convention and Visitors Bureau. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron, Annie Feit, and Mark Earhart. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had help tonight from Dacia Eaton in Anchorage, Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.